All right, we're in Numbers 27. We just finished, if you remember last time, we did 25 and 26. So 25 was where, after Balaam did all his prophecies, where he was only allowed to speak what God said, he came up with the brilliant idea of... Oh, that's okay. This is for chapter 28, just so you know. So we're into 27, so we're not quite there. But basically, Joyce, if it makes you happier at all, this is basically chapter 28. Okay. That's basically what the chapter says. Yes, in chart form. Okay, so, well, actually, you should be even more encouraged. This is 28 and 29 is here. So it's two chapters. Well, yeah, because we'll fly through it is my point, because this is what it says. Oh, man. Anyways, like I said, I told Kyle, I was like, we're within spitting distance of being done. Okay. Anyways, we digress. Yeah, 36 chapters. 25, Balaam's idea of bringing in the women to seduce the men, and it worked. So he couldn't get God to turn on Israel, but he can get Israel to turn on God. And we talked about how Phinehas is jealous with God's jealousy, and so he shish kebabs the man and woman. And that is what appeases God's wrath and stops the plague. But in the end, 24,000 die, and the last of the first generation dies. And so then in chapter 26, we have the census. So the counting of the new military men. Okay? And if you remember from that chapter, right, it is Simeon, the tribe of Simeon, that decreases the most, 37,000 people. And they decrease. Why do we remember? Yes, the guy that got shish kebabbed was a Simeonite, and he was a leader of the Simeonites. So they decreased, and Manasseh was the one that increased the most, and we're going to see the explanation is today in chapter 27. Okay, but chapter 26 also says that in the census, there is no one that is counted that is from the first generation. They are all dead. Okay, except for Joshua and Caleb, because those are the two that God said would survive. So Moses is the remaining one person from the first generation that still has to die before they can enter the land. Okay? And Moses still has to say all of Deuteronomy before he can die. But he is the very last of the first generation that will have to die. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and... Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, because God told him his punishment for his rebellion was that he wouldn't enter the land. Oh,
okay. Yeah, I remember. And so you're looking around, and you're the last person.
Yes. And remember, we talked about this new generation. They're young. The oldest person is 59 years old. So we have Joshua and Caleb. They're going to be older. But everybody else is 59 and younger. Of an entire nation, that is a young nation. Especially when Moses is 120. So they're less than half. The oldest, yeah, is less than half his age because he dies at 120. His life is easy to remember because it's three sets of 40. 40 years in Egypt and Midian, 40 years, 40 years in Egypt, 40 years in the desert in Midian, and then 40 years with the Exodus and leading Israel wandering. So he dies at 120. In a circle, yeah. Okay, so now we're at Numbers 27. Can someone read for me verses 1 to 11?
Then the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, came near, and these are the names of his daughters, Mahlah, Noah, Hoglah, and Milcah, and Tirzah. They stood before Moses and before Eleazar the priest and before the leaders and all the congregation at the doorway of the tent of meeting, saying, "Our father died in the wilderness, yet he was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah. But he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be withdrawn from among his family because he had no son? Give us possession among our father's brothers." So Moses brought their case before the Lord. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, the daughters of Zelophehad are right in their statements. You shall surely give them a hereditary possession among their father's brothers, and you shall transfer the inheritance of their father to them. Further, you shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. If he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. If he has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. If his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to the nearest relative in his own family, and he shall possess it, and he shall be a statutory ordinance to the sons of Israel, just as the Lord commanded Moses.
Okay, so Israel is preparing to enter the land. Like I said, Moses is the last piece that has to happen. His death is the last piece that has to happen before they enter the land. Okay? And so here in chapter 27, we are introduced to the daughters of Zelophehad. Okay? She does really good with the names. Okay. That's right. Okay, these daughters are from the tribe of Manasseh, okay? And that's was key because that is the tribe that in chapter 6 we saw that increased so greatly, okay? Now, we're introduced to a problem. Zelophehad, he himself is dead, right? Verse 3. He died in his own sin in the wilderness, right? Because he's from the first generation, obviously, so he's dead. Because at this point, the entire first generation is dead. And he has only daughters. Okay, so this is the problem. What do you do when you only have daughters and you have no sons to inherit? Okay, verse 1, okay, it says it gives their whole genealogy. And it says that they came near, right? So they have a request, they have an issue, so they properly approach the leaders, which are Moses and Eleazar at the tabernacle. Okay, and also their names are named. Mala, Noah, Hogla, Milcah, and Tirzah, right? So if you ever need names for a daughter, there's some, okay? Notice, if you remember, they were, I'm joking.
I know, but I'm thinking Hogla.
Hogla, yeah, not.
Like the Boogie Tookie thing you had going on in your last video. So I was listening last night. Whatever, like a Tookie Tookie, like the clan you're reading?
Oh, I don't remember.
That's kind of cool.
Okay. But if you remember, they're also mentioned in chapter 26 in verse 33. In chapter 26, verse 33, it sets up for chapter 27, okay? And we talked about how having girls mentioned in a military census is odd, right? Not normal. Why would you do that, okay? But it's a setup for this, and it's going to show their great faith, okay? So they come before Moses and Eleazar, verse 2, and the leaders, okay, and they present their case. Verse 3, our father died in the wilderness, okay, so he was part of the first generation, their father Zelophehad. Okay, and remember, why did the first generation die in the wilderness? What'd they do? Okay, they disobeyed God. They would not go and conquer the land, right? God is giving them the land. He says, come in. I have allowed, you know, I will go before you. And they say, there are giants in the land. We don't want it, right? So basically, they complained and grumbled the whole way there, right? But it wasn't until they totally reject God's gift that then they are cursed to wander in the wilderness. So, right, the land is central to this whole thing. The first generation didn't want the land. God says, fine, you won't get the land. Instead, you're going to die in the wilderness. Okay? So Zelophehad is part of this first generation that went along with the 10 bad spies and rejected the land. Okay? We're going to see that his daughters do not go along with their father in that, okay? So because that first generation refused the land, they had to die wandering, okay? But they clarify that verse 3, he was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah. So he was not part of Korah's rebellion. If you remember Korah's rebellion, is where a bunch, I mean, it was led by Korah, who was a Levite, and two guys from the tribe of Reuben, right? But then there were 250 from all tribes, okay? So Zelophehad could have been part of those 250, but they clarify he was not. He didn't. So basically they're saying our dad died. He just simply died because he was part of that first generation, not specifically struck down by God because he was part of a rebellion. Okay. One of my commentaries thought that if you were involved in a religious offense, that your land was confiscated and you didn't get to inherit. Okay. He brought in Naboth's vineyard. Do you guys remember that story? Where Ahab, King Ahab, wants a vineyard. Do we remember this? Okay, but it belongs to Naboth, and he won't sell it, and Ahab gets really mad and basically throws a sulky fit and will just, like, stays in his room because he didn't get what he wants because he's king. And Jezebel, his wife, says, don't worry, I'll get it for you. So being the good wife that she is, she, at a feast, gets two men to accuse Naboth of blaspheming God. And the people take him out and stone him because he blasphemed God. And once he's dead, then Jezebel was able to get the vineyard. So he uses that to say maybe if you did a religious offense, like blaspheme God, then your land was forfeit. Okay. So that's possible. I don't know if that's true or not. But yeah, I thought so too. That's what I thought too. Because, I mean, it's not like Ahab and Jezebel are really going to follow any of the rules. anyways, they do clarify that their dad just died. He was not part of this rebellion. Okay. Verse 4, why should the name of our father be withdrawn from among his family because he had no son? Give us a possession among our father's brothers. So the daughters are concerned. Their family is not going to receive any inheritance in the land. Now, this is huge. The first generation wanted nothing to do with the land. They wanted to go back to Egypt. They didn't want what God had given them. This second generation wants the land so badly, is so concerned about the land, that this specific family is worried because they only have daughters. There are no men to inherit in their immediate family. And so they're afraid that their dad's name is going to be wiped out because their portion of the inheritance is going to go to an uncle or, you know, something like that. And they themselves, their family, is not going to get the land. Okay? In your name disappearing or being wiped out was often associated with divine judgment. Okay, so they say, yeah, our dad was part of the first generation. He died in his sins. He rebelled, but basically so did everybody else. I mean, like, no one can say, except, I guess, Joshua and Caleb's family, that our dads weren't involved in a rebellion of some sort. So why should he be singled out to be wiped out because he only has daughters? And then they are bold enough to say, let us inherit. Okay, in the ancient Near East, women did not inherit land. It just was not done. Women did not inherit. Okay? Sons inherited. First son usually received a double portion, but all sons would have inherited something. Women were given a dowry. So when they got married, right, they were given stuff, money, clothes, furniture. Sometimes if your dad was super duper wealthy, you might be given a city as well, or some portion of land that then now went to your husband, okay? But when your dad died, you didn't inherit anything, okay? When you got your dowry and that was it, okay? They are saying, let us inherit. Our dad is dead, but we still want a portion. Give it to us, okay? So this is a very bold request. This goes against all tradition, goes against all, you know, of that time what would be done, and they are the ones that are bold enough to go and ask for it, okay? Shows how different they are, this second generation is from the first generation. The first generation wouldn't touch the land with a 10-foot pole. This generation is willing to go against all custom and tradition to say, no, we want the land. It's very serious, Okay, and this is why, well, this is the only reason the Bible gives us to why the tribe of Manasseh increased so greatly. Okay, because they are passionate about inheriting what God has promised them, meaning that they totally, fully trust God's promises, right? We know God's going to give us the land, and we're a bunch of sisters, and we want to make sure we get our fair share of the land, okay? You have to assume also Zelophehad wasn't the only man in all of Israel that had only daughters, okay? But he is the one that had the daughters that were bold enough to step up and do something about it. Okay.
Been born in December.
Oh, yeah? Right. I'm pretty sure not all of them were born in December. There's five of them. Okay. So the daughters, they had to have understood the lesson of the wilderness. The wilderness was to punish the first generation because they did not want the land. Okay. We're not going to be like that. We're not going to be like our fathers. Our father before us. So we want the land. Notice verse 5 too. It says, so Moses brought their case before the Lord, which I thought was interesting. Moses does not laugh them off. Moses does not say, what a ridiculous request. Daughters never inherit, right? Instead, he takes it seriously and he brings the case before the Lord. Okay. This is how Israel was to deal with cases where there was no law, specific law or precedent. Okay, this was a new case. They didn't know what to do. Tradition said, no, women don't inherit. But God had never said blatantly, no, women don't inherit. So Moses brings his case before this case before God. Okay, verse 6 to 11. What's crazy is what God says. Right? The Lord spoke to Moses saying, the daughters of Zelophehad are right in their statements. Okay? God doesn't say, oh, make a good point. I never thought about that. No, he's saying they are right. They did right to ask, and their judgment is right. What they are asking for that they can inherit, that is the correct way to go. Okay? So in Israel, both male and female can inherit. Women can own property. This is huge. Okay? It shows that God views men and women as equal. A lot of times people are going to look at the Bible and say, oh, look at the Old Testament. It's a patriarchal society. Women are down to blah, 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 blah. Okay. Which might have been how it was in the culture, but if you looked at how God says things were to be run, right, it's a whole other story. Okay? So now, did Israel always do it right? No, of course not. Did Israel a lot of times do things just like their neighbors? Yeah. But if you look at what God says, women did have rights. Now, women, daughters didn't just inherit right along with their brother. There is that caveat. But he says, if you look at verse 8, if a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughters. Okay, so daughters inherited if their father had no sons, okay? But also remember, when a woman married, she also became part of her husband's family, okay? That's the way it worked, and so she would then kind of inherit along with her husband, whatever portion he would inherit, okay? Verse 11, it says, at the bottom, it shall be a statutory ordinance to the sons of Israel. This means that this is the way it is supposed to work for the rest of history. Okay? What God says here, this does not just apply to Zelophehad and his specific daughters, like in one little case. This is going to be the law of the land. This is how it is to work for all future generations. And everybody who falls into this category, just because Zelophehad's daughters were the ones bold enough to ask, because of their boldness, all daughters who have no brothers can inherit. Okay? So the way, basically, verses 8 to 11 tell you the order of inheritance was sons, obviously, first. Okay? If there are no sons, then daughters can inherit. If a man dies childless, he has no sons or daughters, then his brothers would get his inheritance. if he had no brothers, his uncles, if he has no uncles, right, his nearest relative would inherit. Okay, so God. And normally, so what's new, normally that was the way of inheritance, except for the daughters were stuck in there. Daughters would never have inherited. Chapter 36 actually returns to this issue and addresses, okay, now that daughters can inherit, what happens when they get married, right? Because a daughter becomes part of the husband's family. So now if she marries, this is going to cause problems, because then theoretically, let's say a daughter of Manasseh married someone, a man from Judah. Now does the land now become Judah's land? And so Judah now owns this little plot of land in the allocation of Manasseh. And basically the answer is, if you are a daughter that has inherited, then you have to marry someone within your own tribe. That was the answer.
So Lafayette's daughters here are not married?
Yes.
Right,
it doesn't say that they are, but yes, I think we can safely assume that they are not married at this time. Okay. Questions, verse 1 to 11. Okay, can someone read for me verses 12 to 22?
Then the Lord said to Moses.
Yes.
Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, "May the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them, and who will lead them out and bring them in, so that the congregation of the Lord will not be like sheep which have no shepherd." So the Lord said to Moses, "Take Joshua the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him, and have him stand before Eleazar the priest, and before the congregation, and commission him in their sight. You shall put some of your authority on him in order that all the congregation of the sons of Israel may obey him. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of Urim before the Lord. At his command they shall go out, and at his command they shall come in, both he and his sons of Israel with him, even all the congregation. Moses did just as the Lord commanded him, and he took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation. Then he laid his hand on him and commissioned him, just as the Lord had spoken to Moses."
All right. Thank you. Okay. So we move from the law of inheritance to what is going to happen once Moses is dead. Okay. So Moses' leadership and his life is nearing an end. He's almost died. He's almost going to be dead. Okay. So Israel needs a new leader. Verse 12 to 14, God instructs Moses to go up Mount Abarim, or in Deuteronomy 32:49, it's called Mount Nebo. Okay, to view the promised land. Aaron and Miriam, they don't even get to see the promised land. Moses, he at least gets to look into the promised land. Okay, and after that, he would die. And again, like I've said, Moses is the last of the first generation that needs to die before Israel can enter the land.
Okay. Right,
till the end of Deuteronomy.
We got one more book of Moses.
Right, but if you remember, what is Deuteronomy?
A repeat of the law.
It's a second telling of the law. So it's like one great long speech from Moses to the people.
Well, no, we won't.
But what I'm saying is, the book of Deuteronomy doesn't take a long period of time. You know, Genesis covers thousands of years. Exodus covers 440 years, you know, but Leviticus took 2 months, right? Numbers is 40 years. Deuteronomy, I'm not 100% sure, but it's only going to take like a month. So, I mean, Moses, by the end of Numbers, is really almost dead. Yes, we have a whole nother book, but it doesn't span a long period of time. And, yeah, of time. Okay, it says that, verse 13, when you have seen it, God's talking to Moses, when you've seen the promised land, you too will be gathered to your people as Aaron your brother was. Okay, so Aaron died, and Moses is going to die too. That gathered to your people, this was the idea that when you died, you joined your faithful ancestors, okay, forefathers, and where you would find rest and peace. Okay, the ideas of heaven and hell are not well developed in the Old Testament, but they did have the idea that life did not end at death. Okay, you would go somewhere else, okay, and gather to your people was the idea that it would be, there would be reward at the end.
Would that be like the bosom of Abraham?
Yes, yes. Okay, then God reminds Moses, as if he needed reminding, right, why he was not allowed to go into the land, why he was going to die first. Okay, and it was because he had rebelled and did not treat God as holy, right? Remember, he strikes the rock instead of speaks to it. Okay, when God had specifically said, speak to it, and Moses rebelled and threw a temper tantrum, and so he cannot go into the land. What I thought was interesting is if you go to Deuteronomy 3, can someone read for me Deuteronomy 3, verse 23 to 27? Deuteronomy 3. Verse 23 to 27.
I also pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, you have begun to show your servant your greatness and your strong hand. For what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do such works and mighty acts as yours? Let me, I pray, cross over and see the fair land that is beyond the Jordan, that good hill country in Lebanon. But the Lord was angry with me on your account and would not listen to me. And the Lord said to me, enough, speak to me no more on this matter. Go up to the top of Pisgah and lift up your eyes to the west and north and south and east, and you will see it with your eyes, for you shall not cross over this Jordan.
Okay, so here we see that Moses pleaded with God and said, God, please just let me walk the land. Just let me go see it and then I can die. You know, and God says, no, you're not, no, you did not treat me as holy. You may look at it, but you are not to walk it. You are not to cross over the Jordan.
But he did let him see it.
But he did let him see it.
It just seems amazing that all the things that Moses did right.
Right.
One yep. Little flaw.
Right. Right. And but see, that's the thing, too. We think of it's just, oh, he just hit it. He was just angry instead of treating God as holy, right? Or doing what God said. But that's the point, is we are called to obey all the time. And any of our sin, right, requires punishment of some sort. And even Moses, it shows that no one is great enough or holy enough or big enough to get away with treating God as not holy, right? And also leaders are often held to a higher standard, right? And so Moses, you are stooping down to the people's level and you are not treating me as holy, and so you are going to receive the same judgment that the people received. And so it seems harsh, but it upholds God in his holiness, that his holiness will not be violated, and especially by the leaders. It cannot be violated. And when you do, you are going to suffer the same judgment. You're not going to get away with it, right? One of my commentators said, no follower of the Lord is immune from sin and its judgment. Now, in Christ, we know that our sin has been taken care of, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to suffer the consequences of our sin, right? A lot of times there are consequences of our sin in this life, right? And just because we're saved and Christ's blood covers our sin doesn't mean that God's going to take away the consequences of our sin, right? We're still going to have to suffer that. So Moses is still 100% saved. It's not like when he dies, he has to, you know, go to hell or anything like that, right? But in this life, his consequence was that he could not enter the land. Yep.
I've always been sad for him
When I was little, I'd keep reading and go, don't hit the rock this time. Do what you're told.
Yeah. Yeah, it's hard.
Disappointed.
Yep.
But we have to live with the actions of our consequences, right?
Our consequence of our actions, yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
But I got you.
And to think, think of how far Moses came. I mean, he went to Egypt when God told him to go set the people free, kicking and screaming. He wanted nothing to do with it. And God tells him, go. He's like, yeah, I don't want to go. I don't want to go. I can't talk. Oh, baloney. Right? And he still doesn't want to do it. And he gets there and he tells the people, right? And they are all angry at him. He's like, see, God, I told you. I don't want to do this. Right? And he goes from that to being the only prophet that God talks face to face. And that's why God said there is coming a prophet like Moses. Because there is no other prophet like Moses. Right? And so we see that in each of our heroes of the faith, we can see how far God brought them, but we can also see their humanity. And that's the great thing about the Bible, too, is it shows us our humanity. They're still not perfect. I mean, we have David, right? Man after God's own heart, and Christ is going to come in the line of David. And yet, he's an absolute failure. We have Abraham, right, who goes from no faith at all to great faith, right? But he still lies several times along the way. And, you know, his life is not perfect either. I think it's encouraging to see these men and how they start out. And it's not like they're these great men to begin with. Right. Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, he ran. Well, because he ran. Because
He didn't get punished for it.
Yeah.
Somebody still saw him, though.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Possibly.
All the rest of them seem to do a whole lot more than his one rock thing.
Yes,
and
right.
And when you consider modern day Christian leaders, Ravi Zacharias, who do all kinds of things.
Right.
All kinds, and just Christian humans, we sin a lot more.
Right.
A lot more.
Right.
Than Moses seemed to, and we don't have.
It doesn't seem. Now, yeah, God deals with us differently because he no longer speaks to us like audibly, right? To Moses or to the prophets in visions and dreams, right? Because we have the full revelation of God, because we have everything that we need, right? We also have to remember Abraham, Moses, Moses is writing the first five books of the Bible. They don't have the scripture. They don't have the revelation. The only thing they would have had maybe was the book of Job. Which sometimes we're like, we'd rather if God just spoke to us. Well, I don't know that we would, right? Because and it's great that we live post-Christ. So God doesn't work the same way, but God also will bring, I think it seems to us like some of these people get away with it, but we also don't know all the details on what God has done or not done or, you know, with disease or whatever. Like, we don't know what is punishment from God sometimes and what is just living in a sinful world. So, but yeah, that's a great question. And maybe he was held to a higher standard, too, because God spoke to him face to face. And he had a special relationship with God that it seems like no other prophet in the Old Testament had.
And a special
position
in terms of leadership
with
his huge
people. Yes. 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 Good question. Okay, so verse 15, it says, then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, may the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation. Okay, so this shows the true heart of Moses. Deuteronomy 3 says that he asked God if he could just go walk the land, right? But when God says no, he submits to God's answer. And now his concern turns to the people. Okay, I'm going to die. Right? I know that. I'm not going to go into the land. Okay, God, they need a leader. They need someone because they're not going to make it on their own. They need someone to turn to. So please give them a leader. What's interesting is Moses calls God the Lord, the God of all the spirit, the God of the spirits of all flesh. Okay? God is only called this here and in Numbers 26:22 in all of Scripture. So it's twice in Numbers, and it's the only time. Numbers 26:22 was part of Korah's rebellion when Moses appeals to God there. Okay? But the idea is that God is sovereign over all men. Okay? He is sovereign over who leads his people next. And notice, God is the one that chooses the leader. It is not Moses' son who takes over, right? The people don't elect someone. They don't get to say who's most popular, who do we want. God is the one that chooses. So it's not, yeah, none of the way we humans do leaders. That's not how it worked. It was God who selects. Okay. So Moses says, oh, Via and Zach are back there as well. Verse 17, Moses is asking for a leader who will go out and come in before them, who will lead them out and bring them in so that the congregation of the Lord will not be like sheep that have no shepherd. Okay, so Moses compares the leadership to a shepherd. Okay, and this idea is developed later in Scripture, right? Where the leader is of Israel is often compared to a shepherd. If you remember, David himself was an actual shepherd, right, before he comes to shepherd the people. And then throughout the prophets, the leaders of Israel are compared to shepherds and bad shepherds at that. Okay? And then obviously Psalm 23 compares the Lord is our shepherd, God is our true shepherd, and then Jesus himself is called the good shepherd. Okay, so this idea is carried throughout all of Scripture. Okay, verse 18, so the Lord said to Moses, take Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Okay, so obviously the man chosen needed leadership qualities and a proven track record. And remember, everybody's super young, 59 or younger. So basically it's kind of like Joshua and Caleb are your only options, right? And if you remember, who is Joshua?
Besides, he was one of the spies that said.
Yes. Right, so Joshua and Caleb, those are the two spies. But what sets Joshua apart from Caleb?
He was helping Moses.
Yes, yes, he was Moses' aide. He was like Moses' right-hand man. Okay? In Exodus 17, he is the one that led Israel into battle against the Amalekites. If you remember, this is right after they come out of Egypt. They are a bunch of slaves. They have no war experience. The Amalekites are attacking, and Moses says to Joshua, form yourself an army and go fight these guys. Okay, so Joshua was the one that did that. Exodus 24, Joshua goes up Sinai with Moses. Okay, when Moses went up Sinai to get the law from God, Joshua goes up, presumably not all the way to the top, but he at least goes halfway up. When they come down because of Exodus 32, because of the golden calf, it's Joshua's like, hey, I hear sound of war. And Moses is like, that's not war, that's revelry, right? The people are partying, okay? And then in Exodus 33, it was Joshua who took care of the tent of meeting. If you remember, this is after Exodus 32 and the golden calf, and the tent of meeting is now moved outside the camp. This is before the tabernacle is built, remember? And Moses literally has just a little tent that he meets God in. And it is outside the camp because Israel has rebelled against God. And so when Moses is not meeting with God, it is Joshua who takes care of that tent. Okay. God calls Joshua a man in whom is the Spirit. Okay. So he was led by the Holy Spirit and is obedient. And God tells Moses to lay your hand on him. So the transfer of leadership is through the laying on of hands. Okay, symbolized by the laying on of hands. Says verse 19, and have him stand before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation and commission him in their sight. So everybody was supposed to see it and Eleazar was supposed to supervise. If you notice verse 20, it says you shall put some of your authority on him. So Joshua is not going to be exactly like Moses, okay? Joshua's going to be the next leader. He's going to do great things, but he is not going to be a prophet exactly like Moses. But he would receive some authority immediately, okay? So there would have been a very short period of time when it would have been Joshua and Moses who were leader of the Israelites. The main difference between Moses and Joshua, verse 21. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. Okay? God spoke to Moses face to face. God was not going to speak to Joshua face to face. If he wanted to inquire of God, what would he have to do?
Inquire to God.
Yeah, but what would he have to do?
Yes,
so he would have to go to Eleazar the priest. He would have to go through the priesthood. And if we remember, the Urim and the Thummim were not exactly sure what they were. They were some sort of lots that the priests were able to cast or do something with to determine the answer from God. Okay, so we don't, the Bible is not specifically really clear about what these were, but whatever they were the priest's way of communicating with God and discerning what God's answer was to different questions. Okay? So that is how Joshua needed to get his answers from God. He was not going to have direct access like Moses did. Okay, verse 22, Moses did just as the Lord commanded him, and he took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation. Then he laid his hands on him and commissioned him just as the Lord had spoken through Moses. So Moses obeys and does everything God says. Does anyone know what the name Joshua means? God is salvation. God is salvation. Yahweh is salvation. Joshua is the same name as Jesus. Okay, they're in the Hebrew, they're the same name, Yeshua. Okay, and he is going to be Israel's military and political leader. Okay, Moses wasn't really a military leader. I mean, they had a couple battles, but like with the Amalekites, it was Joshua who led them. Okay, but Joshua is going to be the one that leads them into the promised land. So he is going to be their political leader, but also their military leader. Okay, can someone read for me Joshua 4:14? Okay, so this is when they are actually crossing the Jordan and they are actually entering the promised land. So it is not until they actually cross the Jordan that the people look up to Joshua just like they looked up to Moses. Okay, but the people do end up viewing Joshua like they viewed Moses. Questions, chapter 27. Okay, chapters 28, I only prepared 28, so we might end a little early, but this chart is for 28 and 29, okay? Basically, chapters 28 and 29 list the regular sacrifices that were to be made throughout the year, throughout the calendar year, okay? Sacrifices at the heart of OT worship. Okay, and these are going to be, the focus is the sacrifices that the priests had to make on behalf of the nation. So this is the bare minimum, all right? Your sin offerings, your fellowship offerings, your voluntary offerings, those are not included. Okay, those were all up to the people and they could bring it whenever, okay? This is the priests on behalf of the nation of as a whole, what was the bare minimum that they had to offer, okay? These laws, I know, more sacrifices, we're all excited about it, but these laws look forward to being in the land, being blessed by God and having the abundance available to offer all of this to God, okay? Every year in the future, this is a quote from one of my commentators, the priests have to offer 113 bulls, 32 rams, 1,086 lambs, offer more than a ton of flour and 1,000 bottles of oil and wine. Okay? This is the bare minimum. of what they would offer. Okay, so to keep these laws, God had to make Israel prosper agriculturally. Okay, so what we're going to talk through, at least chapter 28, every day they offered two lambs, one morning, one evening. Okay, and no, okay, so under the burnt offering, if you remember, so the burnt offering, you have bulls, rams, and lambs, and then we have a sin offering over here of a goat, okay, for some of them. Okay, when you offered a burnt offering, you had to offer also a grain offering, and the grain and a wine offering. So the grain offering included grain and oil, and then also wine. And so it depended on what type of animal you were offering, on what type of grain offering you had to offer, if you remember from our study of sacrifices. For a bull, you had to do, because remember, the bull's the most valuable, you had to offer 3/10 of an ephah of flour, a half a hin of oil, and a half a hin of wine. A ram was 2/10, 1/3 of oil, and 1/3 of wine. A lamb was 1/10 of flour, ephah of flour, a 1/4 a hin of oil, and a 1/4 a hin of wine. Okay, so it's just less. The smaller the animal, the less the grain on wine offering were. Okay, but when it's talking about all these sacrifices, the grain and wine are also there as well. Okay, so every single day, morning and evening, lambs, two lambs, one in the morning, one in the evening were offered. On the Sabbath day, two more were offered. So the four in a parentheses means a total, right? Because you have the two on the Sabbath and then the two for every day. So on the Sabbath, the priests are actually offering a total of four. Okay, it's not instead of, it's in addition to. Okay, on the first of the month, every first of the month, you offered two bulls, and you being the priest. The priest offered two bulls, a ram, seven lambs, but then it says, so this is what I thought of. It says nine, right, because you have to offer two lambs every day anyway, right? But if it's also the Sabbath day, right, then you're going to offer an additional two, because the first of the month can happen on a Sabbath. So then you would have 11, but unleavened bread. So that's Passover, but this is also, this is celebrated for seven days. Two bulls, one ram, seven lambs every day for 7 days.
And these are all and.
Exactly. And correct. Now, correct. So now.
Four comes into play with personal sacrifices on the part of individuals, not these.
Yes. Yes. So in unleavened bread, now unleavened bread is never going to be the first of a month, right? Because it's the 15th through the 21st of the first month, right? But it's, you're going to do unleavened bread sacrifices every day, plus the two lambs that are offered every day, plus it's 7 days long. One of those days is going to be a Sabbath day, so then you're going to add the two for the Sabbath. Okay, so they, just because this is a special day and you're offering a bunch of sacrifices doesn't mean you get exempt from the other sacrifices that are also supposed to be added that day. Does that make sense? Joyce?
How did they remember all that?
How's the,
they have a chart made up?
Maybe.
Calculators were invented a lot earlier.
Abacus. Yeah, that's right.
It just amazes me how there's just so much.
Right. Right. And so then we can be so extra thankful that Jesus died and did it all. Okay, Pentecost.
That would have had to really prosper animals.
Yes, and that is exactly. They are going to be prosperous in the land because all these lambs have to be 1 year old.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I mean, this is why they have an entire gate in Jerusalem called the Sheep Gate. Okay, because the lamb business was a big business, because that's where obviously you can see most of the sacrifices are going to be sheep. I mean, he said 1,086 sheep a year, and this is bare minimum. Okay, bare minimum.
The priests didn't keep any sheep, did they?
What do you mean?
I mean, the priests didn't have their own herds or.
They did. They did.
Probably for their own personal offerings.
Yeah. And at the temple, by the time the temple, you could come and purchase your sacrificial animal. You didn't have to bring your sacrificial animal. But they would have had from the offerings. Remember, the priests and the Levites got they got the firstborn animal, and they also got a tenth, the tithe. Now, the Levites got the tithe, but the priests got the firstborn, and so then they would have had their flocks, or they would have used them for these sacrifices. And there had to be, I don't know exactly how they were provided with all these animals, but they had to have them readily available because they had to have two lambs every single day of the year to offer. Okay? Yes, without blemish. Right, right, right. Yes.
Not only bless their livestock, you bless the perfect.
Yes.
Livestock.
Yes. Okay. Pentecost, again, the same idea. This is 50 days after unleavened bread, two bulls, one ram. Oh, sorry, we haven't even talked about the goats. One ram, seven lambs, and then a goat sin offering. So the sin offerings start with the first of the month. Okay, unleavened bread, Pentecost. Okay, the first of the seventh month, you had extra. Okay, so the first of the month, you offer two bulls. But on the first of the seventh month, you have to offer an additional one. So it's going to be a total of three. Okay, because it's the first of a month, but it's the seventh month. If you remember, the seventh month is the most has the most festivals in it, because it also has tabernacles and Day of Atonement in it. Okay, so this is like a high festival month. So on the first of that month, you offer an additional bull, an additional ram, and an additional seven lambs. Okay, and plus your goat. So now you have two, because you have the one sin offering goat for your first and seventh month and the one for the first of the month. Okay? Day of Atonement, one bull, one ram, seven lambs, and a goat. And then tabernacles, look at this. You start with 13 bulls on the first day. 12 bulls the second, all the way down to seven. On the eighth day, it's just one. Okay. But as you can see, it's a lot of sacrifice.
Is this for every family?
Or? No, this is the priests on behalf of the nation. Okay. So this is these are not individuals at all. Individuals can bring their own sacrifices, right? I mean, think of Passover. Okay, unleavened bread. This does not include Passover lamb, because the Passover lamb was a lamb that you individually brought, right? And it was per family. Or if my family's not big enough to eat an entire lamb, then, you know, we might join up with the bronze and together we can eat a whole lamb. So we would bring a lamb. Okay. But think of how many lambs were slaughtered at Passover. And I don't know if you remember Kyle's sermon, but that's why with the argument of when Passover was exactly, Passover really turned out to be 2 days, and they would sacrifice lambs on 2 days, right? Because Jesus ate Passover Thursday night, died on Friday, but he also died at the time that they were still sacrificing Passover lambs, because some people celebrated Passover Friday night that year. Okay, I don't know if you remember that sermon, but there would have been so many lambs to sacrifice that it took them 2 days to do it. And so the argument of when exactly the 14th was, it fell on 2 days on when they did it. I don't know if you remember that or not. But, I mean, this calculation does not even count that, because those were individual people bringing lambs to be sacrificed for their meals. Yes, and that's the argument of when the day was. Yes, when the 14th was.
I remember that came into play too, but I couldn't remember a whole
yes.
lot of details anymore.
Yes, I can't remember exactly the argument either. It's confusing.
You know,
but
it's when it changed, where, you know, the new morning
right.
is the new day,
right.
the night is
right.
the day.
Right. All right, can someone read for me verses, we're not going to read this whole chapter, but can someone read for me verses 1 to 8?
To them, this is the fire offering to you, or to present to the Lord. Present to the Lord. Each day present two unblemished year-old male lambs as a regular burnt offering. Offer one lamb in the morning and the other lamb at twilight, along with 2 quarts of fine flour for a grain offering mixed with 1 quart of olive oil from crushed olives. It is a regular burnt offering established at Mount Sinai for a pleasing aroma, a fire offering to the Lord. The drink offering is to be a quart with each lamb. Pour out the offering of beer to the Lord in the sanctuary area. Offer the second lamb at twilight, along with the same kind of grain offering and drink offering as in the morning. It is a fire offering, a pleasing aroma to the Lord.
Okay, like Marion pointed out, the focus is on God in verse 2, right? The my's and me's are capitalized. You shall be careful to present my offering, my food, my offerings by fire, a soothing aroma to me. Sacrifices were a gift to God, but really they were first a gift from God. Okay, so we are giving back to God what is already his. Okay, now he says, my food, my offering. Okay, the Israelites did not believe that God needed this food to eat. Okay, which is very important to make clear, because in the ancient Near East, the gods needed the sacrifices of their worshipers in order to eat. If they did not sacrifice, if the worshipers did not sacrifice, the gods did not eat. Okay, Yahweh is not reliant on his people like that, right? It is an act of worship. It is giving back to God a portion of what he has given us. Okay, that's what sacrifice is. It's not like God needed man in order to live. Okay, but all life and blessings come from God and belong to God, and sacrifice is just returning a portion. Okay, he calls them my at their appointed time. This is specifically a religious assembly. Okay, the feasts were scheduled around Israel's agricultural calendar. And were part of the purpose was to thank God for providing for them, okay? And in this, as you notice, the vast majority of the offerings are burnt offerings, which are wholly burnt to God, right? The priests don't get a portion. The worshiper doesn't get a portion. None of that. All of it goes to God, okay? It's all burnt to a crisp. This is total dedication to God. That's the idea, okay? Verse 3 through 8, so this is the first every day, morning and evening. Every day there is a year-old male lamb with the grain offering is offered, right? This shows that God is to be worshipped continuously, all the time, right? There is never a day that God is not worshipped, morning and evening, all the time, okay? In the New Testament, Romans 12:1 says that we are to be living sacrifices, right, to God. And then 1 Thessalonians 5:16 to 18 says that we're to rejoice always, pray without ceasing, and in everything give thanks, right? So that is part of our sacrifice to God, and it's supposed to be constant, continual, all the time. Okay, so the idea of constant worship of God carries forward into the New Testament. But that's the idea here. Israel was to always, always be in worship of their creator God. Okay, Numbers 28, 9 through 10 talks about the Sabbath. And what's interesting is everybody gets to rest on the Sabbath except for the priests. They get double the work. I mean, of the normal day, right? So double the daily sacrifice. Sabbath was to imitate God in creation week by resting. We know that. It was a reminder of the covenant. And Deuteronomy 5 tells us it was also a reminder of their deliverance from Egypt. Okay, Deuteronomy 5, 12 to 15, it's a reminder of their deliverance from Egypt. So Sabbath was a very important day, but the priests, they don't get to rest. I mean, they still have to do their daily work. Okay, because every day, regardless, sacrifice has to be made. On Sabbath, it's double up. Okay, Numbers 28, 11 to 15. This is the new moon, or the first of the month, and this is new for here. Okay, in Leviticus, we haven't run across this new moon sacrifice. This is a significant celebration. Not much is said about it, but the number of sacrifices are the same as for any of the other, well, at least for unleavened bread and Pentecost, right? You do the same 2 bulls, 1 ram, 7 lambs, okay? So it's a significant celebration. Can someone read for me Numbers 10:10?
the day of your gladness and in your appointed feasts and on the first days of your months, you shall blow the trumpet over your burnt offerings and over the sacrifices of your peace offerings. And they shall be as a reminder of you before your God. I am the Lord your God.
Okay, so here we learn that on the first of the month, when they offered these burnt offerings, they were to blow trumpets. Okay, so it's a celebration. Can someone read for me Psalm 81, verse 3?
Blow the trumpet at the new moon, at the full moon, on our feast day.
Okay, so it was a feast day. This is a celebration for Israel. Can someone read for me Amos 8, 5? Amos 8:5.
Saying, when will the new moon be over, so that we may sell grain on the Sabbath, that we may open the wheat market, to make the bushel smaller and the bushel bigger, to cheat with dishonest gain?
Okay, so obviously this is in condemnation, but they're anxious for the new moon to be over so they can sell their grain again, right? So they can continue cheating people. So on the new moon, festival of the new moon, which was the first of every month, they wouldn't buy or sell. There was no trading going on. If you remember the story in 1 Samuel 20, okay, this is Saul and David. David is talking to Jonathan and he says, okay, let's put your dad to the test to see if he really hates me or not. Okay, I'm not going to show up to the new moon feast. If Saul misses me, say I had to go to Bethlehem. If he's angry, then we know Saul doesn't like me. If he is like, oh, that's fine, then we know Saul is okay with me. I don't know if you remember that story, okay? But it's the new moon feast that David is missing from Saul's table, okay? So this would have been a feast. The first of every month. Think of that. Celebration. Every 28 days. You get another one. Okay?
So when you have first of the month up there, that's actually the new moon.
Yes. Yes. I know. Sorry.
That's okay. No,
yep.
Okay.
It's called different things. Yes. Yep. Yes. 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 So that's a new moon feast.
Gorgeous.
Oh, yeah.
Did you take a picture and put that picture?
Yeah.
Sunrise.
Yeah. All right. Numbers 28:16 through 25 is all about unleavened bread. There's nothing really new in here. It's 7 days. Unleavened bread is 7 days, the 15th through the 21st of the month. This is the first feast of the year. Okay. And so it's a lot of sacrificing every day. And what's not even included here, like I said, is the 14th of the month, which is Passover, which is everybody's lambs that are brought in. Not included because those are individual and not just from the priests.
Verse 16 is the Passover, but you just mean they didn't go into it.
Right, because it just says then on the 14th day of the first month shall be the Lord's Passover. On the 15th day of this month shall be the Feast of Unleavened
Bread.
Right. And there's no sacrifices talked about for the 14th because those are everybody's individual sacrifices that are being brought in. And the focus here is on what the priests have to offer for the whole nation, regardless of what the people bring. Yes, you are correct.
Is the unleavened bread when they have to clean out every piece of bread crumb?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. No yeast. For 7 days. At all leaven has to be out of your house. Yes.
Out of the house completely.
Yes. Out of the house completely. Yes.
But that's also the individual thing, and then this
yes.
is also the corporate.
Yes. 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 But this feast for unleavened bread, it's 7 days, and so you are offering 2 bulls, 1 ram, 7 lambs, 1 goat. The priests are every day for those 7 days, for the 15th through the 21st of the first month. Then Numbers 28, 26 to 31, this is the Feast of Weeks or Pentecost, as we typically know it, or first fruits. Okay, lots of names for all the same thing. This is 50 days after Passover. This is after the wheat harvest. Okay, later in Jewish history, this feast was a celebration of the giving of the law at Sinai. It came to be associated with that. And obviously, we associate Pentecost with what? The coming of the Holy Spirit. It was here, right, that the Holy Spirit came on the apostles after Jesus' death. Okay, remember, he died at Passover. Okay, and 50 days later is Pentecost. And it's another big feast, and that's why all those people were in Jerusalem when Peter comes out and preaches and everybody hears it in his own language, right? It's because Jews from all over had come to Jerusalem to celebrate Pentecost, and that was when the Holy Spirit came.
Which was 10 days